violence training. Now, my guest today, I'm really excited for the guests that we have today. So these are two folks who I've looked up to throughout my career. Two of my favorite people in this industry, both IHSS past presidents. Today I'm joined by Paul Sarnese and Lisa Terry. So thank you for joining us today and thank you for sharing your expertise.
Thank you, Brian. Really looking forward to this.
All right. And I'm looking forward to it myself. We're going to jump right in. And just before I do that, just a couple of housekeeping items. If you do have questions, feel free to put those questions, feel free to enter those questions, and I'll be keeping an eye on those, as will our team here, and we'll answer as many of your questions as we can. But I'd like to start off the conversation, and I'll direct the first question to Lisa. Now, Lisa, one thing I'd like to unpack here is just how some of the ways that we can use data to create an evolving workplace violence training program. And really just encompassing that all staff receive adequate training for the risk that they face.
Absolutely. We have to look at the healthcare industry. And the healthcare industry always associates quality and effectiveness with outcomes. And they measure those outcomes. I know every one of us have been in those meetings. And so it's, to me, very extremely important as a security leader that we do the same thing, that we are able to measure our effectiveness with those outcomes. And the data, of course, has got to be tracked and it's got to be analyzed over time. You can measure and reduce, look at how you reduce the number of injuries, like patient assaults on staff, or additional training in PPE, bite sleeves, or measure your workers' comp claims, you know, to the clinical staff, of course, your additional training. And I think the amount of time that we spend on training and equipment could be quantified. And again, you've got to be able to measure that. And then compare that, or at least I have, with your direct costs maybe spent on workers' compensation claims or legal expenses. And you can measure turnover, lost work time, recruitment costs. And again, it's important from a training standpoint that you hear the type and the amount of training of those staff members based on that data analysis.
Now, one thing that you mentioned, Lisa, that I wanted to take a bit more of a look at, because I've heard of this being done before, and you actually brought it up, but putting a value on those lost time injuries, would you mind elaborating on that a little bit and just sharing any insights for the listening audience?
Absolutely. I think it's important that you look at direct costs and then indirect costs. And I think some of those lost time, absenteeism, going out and recruiting when someone does leave, that's kind of indirect. But be able, from a security standpoint, when you're pulling that data, work with your human resources, with your workers' comp, your occupational health and safety folks, and pull those numbers in, integrate that. And again, you know, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but really look at what sort of mitigation efforts, you know, training, and it's a big picture, but especially training. And where do you focus that based on that lost time? I think it's important when you start looking at that. Those are not always measured. We don't think about when someone doesn't come to work a lot. Maybe what is their job? Have they been injured? Is it more psychological? So very important for security to kind of hold hands, in my opinion, with those other departments.
Excellent. Thank you, Lisa. And Paul, would you like to add to that as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, data is everything, right? So every decision we make, every resource we spend, where we spend our time and energy, it's all based on data. And, you know, we're in healthcare, or security in particular, we're kind of competing against the revenue generating departments that always have data on, you know, if it's admissions or door to dock time or left without being seen or whatever it may be. There's data behind that. And we as security and safety professionals need to be able to speak the same language. So having data about if it's lost time, modified duty time, and to be able to put a value on that, there's a great tool, which is the OSHA calculator. So if you go on the OSHA website, you can actually calculate lost time, modified duty time, and so forth. So you can actually quantify it with a dollar figure. But, you know, like Lisa said, having that data, The frequency of injuries, the frequencies of assaults and other security-related data is incredibly important. One of the things that I always advocate for is not only looking at the frequency, so we can look at frequency over time, right? Data over time is really important, but looking at an incident rate. So if it's specific to the ED, you know, it's number of injuries based on ED volume, ED visits. If it's in the acute care setting, it could be based on anything from 100 beds. And that's how IAHS, we do our crime survey based on 100 beds, but you can do it based on admissions. You can do it based on patient days, all those different things. Because I think when you look at data only in frequency, it might not necessarily paint the same picture as when you look at an incident rate over time. But, you know, having that, as Lisa said, you can really do targeted training. You spend your time and energy and resources at the most at risk. And the data, when done correctly, will tell you the unit, will tell you the occupation, will tell you maybe even length of service of the employees. You know, typically in safety, you know, it's the new employees that sustain injuries most of the time, because they might not have the experience and the time on the job. So really having that information at your fingertips really allows you to have that really focused program.
Excellent. And yeah, there's a lot of interesting things that both of you pointed out there, but I think the big thing is being able to put some kind of tangible value on some of those intangible things. And how powerful is it for a security leader to be able to say, because of our workplace violence prevention program, we've reduced absenteeism, we've reduced turnover, and being able to show that correlation.
Now,
when we look at specific training, there's one thing, and you know, this is a bit of a plug for you, Lisa, but you work with Vistalar, and one of the things that attracted me to Vistalar was this whole concept of non-escalation. So, you know, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to expand on that and just kind of share that concept with everybody, because I think this is something that's very valuable that gets overlooked. We focus so much on de-escalation, but can you talk to us about non-escalation?
Absolutely. I think it's important that we look at your total environment, the total conflict management, so that you're not just looking at how we de-escalate. I know that's our buzzword. That's the thing that is in many of the regulatory and accreditation manuals. Do you have a de-escalation plan? But I think something that for 30 years that I was missing in some of my training was the prevention side of things. And, you know, for those of you out there that subscribe to left of bang, you know, and if you don't know what that means, you know, bang is that event that occurs, and left of bang is where we want to be, and that's that proactive mode. And I think that's the part that really resonated with me once I found out about Vistalar, is they really push that the full situation, not just dealing with when you see those activities starting to occur. Really starting with treating everyone with respect. And basically, as I've said before, you know, have that environment where violence is just, it's not a part of your environment at all. You don't accept it. You train to be respectful to one another. You understand not only trauma-informed care, but you become trauma-responsive. You know, teach everyone, your security and your clinicians to be a part of that healthcare team. We're all trying to understand that when individuals come into that hospital environment, all walks of life, all types of situations, and we all need to be responsive to what's coming in that door. You know, part of that, when we walk into a room, is the energy we bring in there. So I know that was a long answer to your question, but we have to be responsible for that.
No, absolutely. And, you know, when I first heard that verbiage, non-escalation, it made me think of a couple of people that I worked with in the past when I was a frontline security officer. One was actually a nurse. He's a physician now, but his name's Craig. And whenever I saw Craig working in triage, I knew it was going to be a good night, because Craig, you know, typically triage nurse, you just hear next when they're calling for the next patient to come up and be triaged. But he would step, he would actually physically step out of the office, call the next person, you know, by, he would call the next person by name, and then he would introduce himself. He'd say, "Hi, I'm Craig. I'm one of the nurses here. I'm going to get you triaged and we'll help you out." And again, when he worked, it was, he got everybody off to a good start, and it seemed like it made the night just go that much smoother. And then there was a security officer I worked with as well, who kind of took the same approach. We were responsible for greeting individuals as they came into the ED. And he just took a more professional approach to it. He went a step farther. He would go and stand out in the triage area or in the waiting area, speak with everybody that was there. And he really helped de-escalate things as well. Prevent escalation of events, because he built rapport with every single person that came through the door. And then when we talk about de-escalation, you know, I'm going to go back to a conversation I had with Mark Reed. And one of the things that he measured at his previous hospital was, again, the amount of times that they de-escalated someone during the shift. And again, since we're talking about data, I think that's just another powerful metric there. The day I had spoken to him, he said they had 11 de-escalations in the previous shift. So again, if you can start putting some tangible values on those things, it's just really showing the value of your department.
Absolutely. And how you're tracking whatever spreadsheet, whatever your incident tracking is, as you make these changes, you know, as Paul said, over time, look at that and look at where these things are occurring. You know, one of the things that I use, Paul, is I try to use adjusted discharges or adjusted admissions, which really account for pretty much every person that's on that, you know, that campus, so that it's not just your emergency department. So you can really kind of get a good feel for how busy that particular campus is at a particular, you know, time of the day or time of the month. But absolutely, I agree 100% with everything you said, Brian.
All right, perfect. Well, Paul, I'll get you to field the next question to start us off. Now, I want to talk just in terms of using data to identify some of those areas of improvements, and really just to measure the effectiveness of our current training as well. So, if you could share some insights just on those topics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have to make sure that we're collecting the data that becomes actionable, right? So it's not only the time, the day, the location, but if we can capture the occupation of the injured, if somebody is injured, if we can capture the length of service that they have, certainly as much information that we can capture that allows us to focus our time and energy and resources on the highest risk units, the better. But even looking at things like body part, God forbid we have somebody that's injured with an assault, right? Is it the hand, the face, the arm, the leg? What is the cause of injury? Was it a punch, a kick, a scratch? All that information is incredibly important. I'll give you a prime example. So I did a retrospective analysis, 10 years worth of data for a large healthcare organization, and was shocked to find out how many bites there were. The staff was being bitten. And these were not dog bites. These were human bites. The training program never included any technique on how to escape a bite. And it was an eye opener. But, you know, we had to dive into data, 10 years worth of data, but it was time consuming, but it was time well spent. That same study, and I'm proud to say this, we were able to take the information to the Nursing Executive Council and say to them, 87% of the staff that was injured were nurses. But right now, we're not requiring any new nurse or existing nurse to go through our de-escalation training. I need your support. We need to change this. So let's start with every new nurse that's hired. Let's have them go through the de-escalation training. We did that. A year later, we measured our results. And there was a direct correlation with the nurses that attended the training. Not a single nurse that attended the training was a victim of violence the following year. And from then, we basically expanded it. We then said, okay, let's look at all of the other nursing roles. We then required it for the ED and behavioral health and our long-term care facilities. And we just kept on going further and further. But it was the data that led us to the action. So I think it's just incredibly important that we really, really dive into it. And we have to be able to articulate. In you know, you walk into a facility, and if you ask a security director, and for those of you that are on the line, ask yourself this question. Where do the majority of my incidents occur? It might not be the ED. It may not be your behavioral health unit. It could be your infectious disease unit. It could be another unit. So you really, if you don't know that answer today, look at your data. If you don't know what occupation is the most injured, look at the data. The time of day, the day of the month of the year, we should be able to articulate that quite freely in our profession.
So just want to kind of have a comment. You know, one of the things, Paul, it wasn't your study, but it was a study on bites that really caused us to drill down and make sure our training was really hitting on how we're not trying to prevent one thing and cause another. So we really sort of focusing on preventing any type of proxemics that would allow a bite to occur. Just really drilling down, but you're exactly right. That was 100% all because of being able to drill down the data. You know, we were able to really, you know, enhance that training.
Yeah, and that was the same note I made just with from Paul's comment was the bites. Like that's kind of astounding to me that bites were the most common occurrence, and there wasn't any training around preventing that or being able to escape a bite. One thing that I kind of want to highlight now, because we've kind of touched on this a few times, is having the appropriate training for staff. Now, I guess, you know, obviously we can use the data to help kind of navigate that. We can see what level of incidents are occurring in different departments and how it's impacting different staff. You've all touched on that. In terms of, I can ask both of you, both having experience in healthcare facilities and, you know, Paul being a consultant, Lisa currently working for a training provider. What recommendations could you give to our audience just on finding a vendor that can adapt the training to meet the needs of the different departments, basically the different trainees within the healthcare organization? And I guess pretty vague there. So Lisa, do you want to start that response off?
Sure. Obviously, I think all of us on this call, we're in the safety business, every one of us. And I think that it's important that you, when you're looking for that partner, that training partner, that you sit down and you talk about, you know, where are our pain points? You know, what are the expectations of staff wherever they are? And then make sure that this training can be adapted and geared to the needs, and really talk to them about what they think the needs could be. You know, one of the things that I've done over the years, we were at one point a restraint-free facility. And I think, you know, we all have heard that. So you have to measure how often the patients are physically restrained. Well, I actually took that information and then I compared it with our calls for service each month, the total calls for service that our officers had. And then how many of those calls were what I called total physical management calls. And that, you know, kind of had that in my, quiver, if you will, to know which ones we had. And over a period of 12 months, half of our calls for service were total physical management calls. Now, the hospital was still, you know, one or two per month were actual restraints. But what we saw was this, this total disconnect between what clinicians were doing and what security was being called in to do. So we were still, you know, responding to those same situations, but as a team, we were not working together. So it really helped me to look at how do we talk to, you know, our executives about where these issues are going, where they're happening. They're not just in the emergency department. They may be up on the med-surg floors. They may be in your on your psych units. They may be up in the OB unit. How do we work as teams? How do we train the security or whoever your response team is with those clinicians so we're all working together to not have these situations? And I mean, that was very eye-opening. Yes, it took me 12 months to really pull that data together. But absolutely, when you're talking to that partner, that vendor, make sure that you really drill down and you look at who needs what type of training.
And Paul, anything that you'd like to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it all comes down to culture. I mean, there is, you have to look at the training programs that are out there and make sure that the training program is right for your culture. It's also right for your patient population. There are programs out there that are geared towards the behavioral health units. There are programs out there that are geared towards pediatrics. Others geared for the general population. So I think first it's, you know, organizations really should see what the offerings are. And, you know, again, you know, Lisa, you said it has to be customizable because every culture is a little bit different. And every implementation strategy could be a little bit different. Every budget's different. So it's really looking at the program, seeing which one's going to fit your culture, and, you know, choosing the one that's also going to be, most importantly, what's going to be the best for your patient population. And then determining, you know, the best way to roll it out. Do you want to do a train-a-trainer model? Do you want to certify individuals? Or do you just want to train individuals? So there's a lot of decisions that have to be, you know, be part of, or a lot of things that have to be evaluated and part of making that decision. So I think customizing it to meet the culture, customizing it to be easy to deliver, meeting the organization's education budgets. You know, it's certainly, you know, there's a cost for everything. But taking staff off of the units, there's a cost associated with that also. So organizations have to include that. So not just the cost of the training, the certification, but it's also the educational dollars that are going to be needed to pull a nurse off of a unit for 8 hours, 16 hours, or whatever's decided. You have to backfill that position. So I think it's looking at all those different things to make sure it's right for the organization. The other thing that I would just caution leaders on is if you're a multi-campus system, and you're training one campus, you're using one program, another campus, you're using another program, that causes confusion for the staff. And you know, one of my favorite sayings is everybody's got to be on the same sheet of music, right? So same terminology, same de-escalation techniques, same physical techniques. So just, again, that standardization of a training program, we're also paying dividends, especially as we start to share resources amongst hospitals. We could have a nurse work in hospital A today and hospital B tomorrow. So really evaluating all those different things prior to making a decision on what training program is the best for your organization, your culture.
So I just want to kind of add too, that was great. I think that one of the things that's difficult for me is to go to HR and say, all right, how do people learn now? This is the 21st century. What can be done that maybe we've not actually tried before? You know, bite-sized learning, that 6 minutes, 8 minutes, 15 minutes, can this partner do that? Can we look at what's the new way to make things happen? Do we have any AI? Do we use some avatars? You know, what do you want to do if you have to use some sort of online on-demand training, which at times sometimes that's what we have to use. It's not just about checking the box. You don't want to say, okay, everybody's gone through their LMS training. You really want it to be valuable when you have those bite-sized learning. And it could be bite-sized from the standpoint of those safety huddles. You know, I've used that for years. That's a time that's already there, but you're exactly right. It's not only got to be hit the right culture, look at time constraints, what can we afford, but also is it valuable? Are these people going to remember it next week when they've not used it for a year? Again, it's that whole thing when we start comparing, and that's the cool thing about using this data is really analyze it and keep it in front of you and make sure it's current over time. And you know, in the 21st century, that's kind of a, you know, for some of us that have been around a long time, people are starting to learn in a different way now.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to take the opportunity of having both of you on this call to ask a couple of things that are I have some strong opinions on, but I definitely want to learn from you. So Lisa, first question I'm going to ask is just in terms of one of the things that Paul brought up was the training being easy to deliver. So I'll ask this to Lisa first and then Paul, I'll get you to follow up as well. But what are your thoughts of leveraging the security team as kind of a train-the-trainer in a lot of these training exercises?
I mean, I think that's wonderful, but I will tell you my success over the years has been that partnership between the clinicians and security. They really need to be joined at the hip. That is, to me, it's wonderful, and I've seen there's buy-in, because I think it's important that we are not pointing fingers at one another. You know, that officer won't do anything, or that clinician, you know, they don't know how to handle that situation. So it's really important that we're all on the same page. And again, pushing that respect and dignity, not only with our patients and visitors, but with one another. You know, one of the things that Paul didn't mention that I thought of a moment ago when he was, you know, pulling out data is I was speaking to a client a couple of weeks ago that their workplace violence had actually pulled out that 20% of the violence that they're looking at is lateral violence, you know, worker on worker, worker to worker. And that's something that we really need to make sure that we're accounting for that as well.
Absolutely. And just to add, several years ago, I had a conversation with Dan Yaros, and he was talking about the concept of team training. And I adopted that. And if you have a security professional and a nurse provide the training to a class, it just brings so much legitimacy to it, and that partnership. Because if we're not on the same sheet of music with our clinical colleagues, things might not go as the way we want them to go. So I am a big fan of security being part of the trainers, but also doing it with other clinicians. You build relationships, you build trust. You know, it's just like a security officer participating in a clinical huddle with the nursing unit. It creates that camaraderie, that teamwork. We're all in this together. And to do that same for training, I think it really helps to maximize the effectiveness of the training. And it gives the officers a potential career path. It gives them the ability to develop themselves. So we're investing time and energy and training into our officers as well. And I think there's only benefits that come from that.
Awesome. And Lisa, you kind of stole the next question that I had. You already started kind of talking about this, but having these multidisciplinary teams training together. I think one thing that I'll share is I think some of my best experiences as a frontline officer doing training was when we had the clinicians in the same training with us, because really at the end of the day, we think differently. It's out of necessity. Like we are all trying to achieve the same goal, but we have different objectives. So with that being said, we do think differently. And I keep saying I'm basically right now, I'm a guy who basically works from my basement or in a hotel room today. You know, I'm not in the healthcare facilities, but I'm still, you know, still really near and dear to me. But I found that those training exercises benefited our programs a great deal. And it really just improved our response.
Absolutely. I think
Lisa.
Go ahead. I'm going to say teamwork. I mean, it's just a team. I remember when one of our facilities putting together a behavioral health specialist, an officer that really was really highly trained and had worked in that environment. It was a pilot project. We had 12 individuals that started in that project. And after the training, and, you know, it was the training involved the clinicians. They were a part of it, bringing this. It was a 40-hour training kind of program. And I came back 2 weeks later, and those officers, their shoulders were back. They were a part of that care team. They were a part of that clinical care team. They were still in, you know, in their role in security, but they were included. It was very inclusive, and it changed their entire demeanor and how they responded. And it was just, I mean, it couldn't have worked out any better. But absolutely. The psychology of that is amazing.
Absolutely. And the other thing is Lisa was talking about use of force. So you have a security officer, you have half security officers, half nurses, and you start talking about use of force. The nurses are going to go, I didn't know that. I didn't know you could do that or couldn't do that. It's invaluable when you can say to the nursing staff, when security arrives, this is what we're going to do. Typically, we arrive to a nursing station. There could be five or six nurses at the station, and we're going to say, okay, who's in charge? Okay, you're in charge. All right, what's going on? Oh, that's going on? Now, what would you like us to do? Now, we can also say to the nurses, and when we respond, this is what we want you to do. There's always somebody in charge. There's always an officer in charge. So if you have a situation that we need to, you know, expedite our response, we want you to say, okay, who's in charge? All right, this is what's going on, and this is the plan. So to have everybody in the same room, to have that conversation, I think is powerful, and it pays off dividends.
The other part of that, just take it one step further. If everyone has been trained together, then even if one individual does not necessarily have some sort of physical intervention skills, everyone knows the terminology. They're all speaking from the same language. So that if, let's, for instance, the officer says, is there something that I can say to you that will convince you to go back to your room, sir? And they know that's the key. Okay, it's probably going to go physical, or it may go physical. So these are some things we all need to be doing, regardless of whether they work in environmental services or in food service or a clinician. They know that's the key phrase, whatever that key phrase is. They know next could be a situation. I mean, and I'm just using that as an example, but I think so important, just even one more step further, that we're all speaking from the same sheet of music. I think, Brian, your terminology there.
Well, it's a beautiful thing when security responds to a floor or a unit, and the nurse looks at security and he says, they're at a level two, or whatever it may be. And everybody knows what that means. And everybody knows what the next step is. That's a well-oiled machine when that happens.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. We can establish that common language. Now, I'm going to just share one of the comments here. So this wasn't a question, but Scott Levy shared this and kind of speaks to what we were just talking about. What he said was, we built a cadre of 20 instructors for our workplace violence training, including physicians, nurses, research, education, et cetera. So again, multidisciplinary training team.
I'd say that physician champion is huge, because right, physicians have a part in it. So a doctor that says in front of the patient, we're going to restrain you, is a problem. Or a physician that says, you know, if to a patient that, you know, we are going to commit you, and it may not deliver the message the right way, that could cause a problem for everybody that's part of that response team. So I think it's outstanding that they have programs with the clinical champions like that. That's phenomenal.
Yeah, and there's a lot of value in that. I think one thing that I'll kind of highlight here is thinking of one of my buddies here in well, not here, I'm not in Canada right now at this moment, but one of my local colleagues, his team, his security officers, because he has a team of guys who happen to hit the gym a lot, and they actually help with when a patient comes in recess, like they'll be doing the chest compressions. So that's just part of their standard. The security team handles that portion of it. Again, you mentioned some of the training that we can do, those safety huddles. Again, I know Mike Hodges, that's something that he takes advantage of with his program as well. But yeah, all good ways to really embed your security team into the hospital. So you're seen as a valued resource, just being able to help in so many different capacities. Now, I'm going to shift gears with another question here, and Paul, I'll pitch this one to you first. And now what I'd like to talk about is using the data that we're collecting to develop a comprehensive prevention plan. So that can include things like policies, training, and really just tailoring that to the organization. So yeah, if you could share with us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, so a comprehensive program, right, starts with management commitment. We need to make sure that our leaders are on board from the top down. Doing our physical environment assessment. The one thing that I always employ that others look at is really the quantitative data is real important. but there's also qualitative data as well. So getting the voice of the customer is really important, speaking to the staff about are they getting the right training and so forth, and how do they feel? Because security is not something that's tangible, right? So really getting that perspective. But the policies and the procedure, all those different things really should be driven by data. Policies and procedures, I think that's the easy part, right? We can always write a policy, write a procedure, but it's the implementation and making sure that we're using the same terminology, the same response protocol. All those different things are incredibly important. But I think just to kind of emphasize a little more on the qualitative data, I'm a big fan for doing like security opinion surveys and asking employees, you know, have you used security services in the last 12 months, yes or no? Were they timely, professional, knowledgeable, courteous? What improvements would you like to see made? Visiting a hospital had low incident rates, significant investment in security, significant. But none of the employees felt safe. When I spoke to them, it was, I don't feel safe walking at night. I don't feel the and so forth and so on. And it was in contrast to what we thought we were going to hear. So now you have a situation where the data says, well, things are really good. The incidents are really low, but the employees don't feel safe. So there was a disconnect in this particular organization that we had to address. And it was marketing. This is what we're doing for you. This is how easy things. This is how you get in touch with security. This is what we're here for. These are the services that we provide. These are the value-added services we provide. So I think looking at both quantitative data is important to help develop the program. I also think we can't forget about that qualitative data. I know a lot of organizations this year, specifically with the new Joint Commission standards coming out, they added some questions in their culture of safety surveys or their employee engagement surveys. And I think that's really important to do because it kind of gives you that baseline of data, but it's going to be constantly evolving, right? So we implement a program, we implement training, we do something different to address a risk. We have to go back and measure that impact. Did it give us the return that we expected? And if not, no harm, no fail. We do something different, right? So, you know, I've always been one that never been afraid to fail. At least we're trying something different. But, you know, the data, again, should be something that's driving the program development, driving the policies, driving the training, driving resource allocation, and so forth.
I agree. And basically, I think you mentioned how there was a lack of trust on, you know, they didn't feel safe. And I think it's important, too, that we, our staff are trained on actually how to properly, you know, collect the data, how to analyze it, and how to look at trends. And even if they're not getting the, you know, it's not looking good, then it's really important that we live with that, and we have a plan for, you know, that mitigation. And, you know, putting together your workplace violence prevention plans and your training strategies, I think they've got to be developed so that you have a little bit of wiggle room so you can pivot based on that data. You know, it could not be hard and fast. There's got to be a little bit of fluidity in there so that it gives you that ability. One of the things that I did, and of course, it's got to be relevant and it's got to be current. Keep going back to that. That's huge for me. But one of the things that I did, and I actually got this from an article in the Journal for Protection Management that had me really kind of look at things in three buckets. First, you look at your risk characteristics of whatever that location is. You may look at your community crime rate, your CAP index. You know, you mentioned emergency department visits. In the hospital, these are characteristics that your security leader really just can't change. They don't really impact, but you still need to know what those are. And when you're building that program, just know, okay, my trauma center may be located here, and we have a lot of things going on. Then look at the second bucket is your security program characteristics. And it should perhaps include the actual hours per week that you're able to staff these various locations. You know, make sure that you're looking at that. What type of conflict management program? Does it cover the entire spectrum? from non-escalation to de-escalation? And what kind of visible video surveillance? Do you have any type of visible emergency communication system, your parking area, your PPE, other equipment? And these are the things that your workplace violence program and your security leader probably does have a little bit of an impact. You know, how we deploy staff, how we get funds for various things, and how we make that argument. So you've got those two buckets. Then the third bucket is your outcomes. Start looking at, again, I go back to workers' comp, numbers. Those are always really good to look at. What kind of assaults are you having? Are you having hits, kicks, bites, fitting? You know, is there a lot of threats coming in? And as these risks are added, or are they're changed, and as your program mitigation efforts are added or changed, make sure that you're looking at that big picture. What have I done over here? One of the things you mentioned, Paul, was sometimes that that tenure, if an officer is really young, maybe that we need to move some staff that have a little more tenure to that location, or vice versa. If there's individuals that maybe, don't take things quite as seriously, they've been on the job for a long time, let's look at that. You look at the big picture, and until you start having that data and training people properly, it's kind of a hit and miss. You don't really know what's going on. So, again, from the training standpoint, I look at data all the time.
Excellent stuff. Now, I have a question here from Ted Sandquist, and you kind of touched on this earlier, Paul, when you were talking about culture, but we'll go with Ted's question here and elaborate a little bit. But what are your thoughts in regards to building a culture of safety versus a one-off class that everybody has to go to each year? So just, you kind of talk about that checkbox training.
Yeah, I think we've probably all experienced the flavor of the month in our organizations at some time in our career. And safety, security, workplace violence certainly cannot be one of those, because culture, safety is everything, right? We what we do in healthcare is meaningful, purposeful, impactful. We change people's lives. We come to work to help people heal. We don't come into work to get hurt by somebody. But that culture has to be consistent and put employee, patient safety first. That's what we have to do. So it can't be the flavor of the month, but it's not easily accomplished, because there's always something that comes our way that's going to take our attention to something different than safety. It could be finances, it could be patient engagement, and it could be something else that's going on in the community. So to have a program that it has to be hardwired. It has to have the structure, the rigor in it, so that it becomes part of the culture, and it doesn't become the flavor of the month. It's not easy, but it's achievable with leadership commitment, and the right structure, and the right rigor, and the right processes in place.
I mean, I second that. I think if you look at we create a culture where we treat each other with dignity and respect. Once that culture, and again, Paul, it starts at the top. And sometimes those of us, in training, we have to kind of touch ourselves and say, look, yeah, Lisa, as we're talking, remember, we let's make sure we're treating each other with that same dignity and respect all the time, no matter how you feel. I go back to focusing on that environment where it's incompatible with violence. So we don't allow it to come in, to our area, but it has to be the culture every single day, how we speak to one another. It goes over. I remember hearing one speaker once talk about how they faked it. The staff didn't really feel it, but they started faking it, and all of a sudden the it started being nice back to them. And then it kind of became that reciprocal situation. So important that it starts with the culture.
Absolutely. One of the things I was thinking about as well is, because I've seen some really great programs and I've seen some not so really great programs. But the organizations, I believe that it's part of just who every, they just, it's part of their culture. So organizations that have, if they call them their pillars or their foundation or their values, or when safety is part of that, that sends a powerful message to the employees, but the employees embrace it. It's one of our values. It's on the back of my badge. Safety is important. My safety is paramount. I think that it may seem small and simple, but it's very powerful.
Absolutely.
All right. There's another comment here just talking about recruitment, which I think is a challenge for everybody right now in every line of work. But this is speaking obviously specifically about healthcare security. Now, the comment is HR plays a large role in the proper recruitment, and healthcare security operations is a completely different animal than corporate, yet HR rarely sees that distinction. So I'll kind of follow up on that comment and just talk about my experience. One of the big catalysts for my leadership journey in security was getting involved with the hiring process. And for us, I could say the same thing. We had an HR system that filtered out a ton of candidates based on some criteria that really, you know, some of them didn't need to be there. Now, I got permission from my leadership at the time to connect with HR and see what we could do. And, you know, surprisingly to me, but maybe it shouldn't have been, they were willing to let me kind of work with some of those processes because, again, they don't understand our field, right? So I had done a lot of research, applied that, and some of the things that we implemented greatly improved our hiring processes. But Lisa or Paul, anything that you'd like to share just with regards to recruitment and how we can partner with HR to make sure that we're achieving our objectives?
Lisa, I'll let you go first.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So I think one of the most important things that I did some point in my career, probably a long time ago, was hook up with the recruiter and say, can you please spend the day with my team? Can you see what our security officers do? How can you recruit for these positions if you have no idea what we do? So yes, we go to the morgue. Yes, we're gonna smell things and see things we really don't wanna see. But then we're gonna have to turn around and put a big smile on our face and say, good morning, welcome, good to see you, can I help you? You have to really appreciate the role of a security officer to be able to recruit appropriately. Brian, I had a very similar situation. You know, when I started a new position, the requirements for security were prior law enforcement, prior military. That was it. So you excluded this whole group of people. And I said, let's just look at customer service. I know it's a big category, but let's look at customer service. The first officer we recruited was a used car salesman. And he turned out to be our best security officer we ever had because he understood customer service. And we were able to teach him the technical patrol and report. And we were able to teach him all those other things. So I think bringing HR into your team, having them sit down with your officers, what's a typical day? What do you do? That really helps them recruit for those positions.
Yeah, I think, you know, that there's so many things that I can talk about that I've learned or I'm still learning. But one is once you've got them on your side, maybe have them come with you and conduct an interview, a walking interview with a client, with an applicant. You know, good Lord, what 70% of our job is walking. It is not sitting. It is going out there and being and doing. So, you know, we talk a lot about fit for duty. It's not about necessarily that use of force fit for duty. It's literally about physically being able to go and do and be and the customer service, but all of the above. And I think if that recruiter can see the big picture, not just look on a piece of paper or talk to them, actually get out there and walk and see how much of the day is going to be moving. And then the second side of things is if you happen to have a contractor or a contract security company, I think it's really important that before you ever bring those individuals online onto your campus, you really talk about how that's going to transpire. How are those officers going to be recruited and what is your role in choosing those? And if you don't have a direct role before they come to you to be, you know, that last sort of interview, then make sure there's some stop gaps in there so that everybody is on the same page. I think that I do know that there is some challenges when it comes to contracting with a company that's not necessarily healthcare centric.
And Brian, I just wanted to add this because it's fresh in my mind. Walmart. Walmart's sticking out in my mind. So if Walmart is paying $16 an hour for a clerk, and we're paying $16 an hour for a security officer, it's very, very difficult to recruit. So doing those market analysis, I think, are huge. And I bring up Walmart because that's what initiated a market analysis in my prior employer. I was checking out at Walmart, and I took a picture of the $16 an hour. And that turned into a market analysis, which then turned into 85% of our officers getting a raise to retain that. So really, those market analysis, I think, could help in recruiting, especially if we're starting off at a lower rate than a Taco Bell or Walmart. That's an issue.
And it's got to be healthcare. You know, there is market analysis out there that sometimes it costs a little bit more money, but it needs to be very centric for healthcare. That's not the norm. Sometimes security is believed to be security, and it's not always the case.
No, absolutely. One thing too that I'll mention, looking back at that hiring experience, one of our filters was having requiring 5 years of security experience. I thought of that when you made the reference to military or law enforcement experience. And you know, it's not necessarily a terrible metric, but I don't think it should be a disqualifier, because when I went through all of the resumes that were rejected, there were some really good candidates in there. Maybe some of them had 4 years experience, but they just didn't check the right box, right? So. And part of that, I remember there was someone who we hired who done loss prevention, but I knew from their employer, they worked at some place where they couldn't go hands-on. So everything they did had to be communication. So I assumed they would be good communicators. So let's get them in for an interview. Michael McCabe actually shared something, he didn't hire a used car salesman, but he brought in a stockbroker who he said turned out to be excellent as well.
Well, Brian, you made me think about the same employer had, you had to be 21. And we eliminated that as well. Now, you had to be 21 to drive the vehicle because that's what our insurance company required. But we dropped it to 18. It was based on the argument that I can join the military at 18, but I can't be a security officer. I can go through the police academy at 18, but I can't be a security officer. It made no sense at all. So also kind of encourage the listeners to also look at the age, because you also may be excluding a great pool of talented individuals.
Oh, 100% agree. Another thing that you made me think of there as well, you talked about HR having them partner up and just spend a day with the security team. I just wanted to call out some exceptional leaders here, but Peter Pisters, who's the CEO at MD Anderson, he was the CEO at University Health Network for some of the time that I was there. And I remember when he first started, one of the things that he did was he went to every department. He spent time with every single department from the info desk across the board, just to kind of get a feel for what they did at the hospital. And John Westall, I know he does the same thing with his team as well. He spends a day working in one of those roles, so whether it's the kitchen or whatever. So again, kind of just speaks to those points that you mentioned, Paul.
I think Jonathan has 10 different uniforms in his office.
Yeah.
One for food, one for plant, one for, he does.
Yeah, well, it's not like he can borrow them because he's what, like 6'5"? So there's not too many people who have a spare uniform around for someone of that size. All right, well, I'm just looking at the time here. We answered all of the questions that came in, and we got some great content there. I learned something every time I speak to either one of you. So this was a great experience for me personally, and I'm confident that everybody who was listening picked up at least one thing new. So hopefully you've picked up something that you can apply today. And of course, if you wanted to follow up with Paul or Lisa, they're very easy to find. I always recommend LinkedIn as the best way to connect with people. But again, I can speak personally and say that they're always willing to share. They've shared a lot with me. And yeah, with no further questions, I think we'll give everybody 5 minutes back to get to your next meeting or get a bit of a break. But we appreciate you joining us today for our webinar, and look forward to seeing you on the next one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, there we go. Well, thank you guys again for coming on right now. There's a few people still just leaving the webinar, but I stopped the recording. I just wanted to make sure to personally thank you for doing this, because this meant a lot to me. I think very highly of both of you. So this was a really fun experience for me, getting to have a conversation with the two of you at the same time.
So you always make it easy.
Yeah, it's so easy to talk to.
Yeah,
in fact, I'm going to, probably before the end of the year, I'm probably either going to do a podcast or a webinar, and I may be grabbing the two of you. We'll have a different, probably, some of the same stuff. It's just so easy, and I love it. Love talking with you.
That's cool.
Thank you again, all from us. It was a great webinar.
Excellent.
I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. I love listening to all the three of you. Thank you so much for joining us and being a part of this.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love these, because obviously I'm not in a healthcare facility today, but there's always stuff that gets said that I can apply to what I do today, which is, again, it's invaluable.
Well, and Paul has been in a facility the most recent. So, listening to yours are relevant and they are current. So I love hearing it.
We learn something new every day, don't we?
Yes, we do.
We do.
Absolutely. All right. Well, so we've got this recorded. I know, I think Bettina will download it, and our team will get this edited and get it up, and we'll make sure to share that information with you once we, get this out there for a larger audience who wasn't able to join today.
Sounds great.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Have a great day.
Bye.
Stay well.
Take care.
You too. Thank you.